Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. My personal copy of the Bible consists of 1,575 double-columned pages, from In the Beginning, the opening phrase of Genesis, to the final chapter of Revelation, which promises I am coming soon. But poets have added to what some biblical stories tell us. They give voice to characters who have no voice. That is, they imagine what the Bible left out. So, while 1,575 double-columned pages might seem exhaustive, poets remind us that there's much more to consider. The title for today's episode, Revised Bible Stories. Genesis tells us Noah was 500 years old when he begot his three sons. With whom did Noah beget these three sons? The author says absolutely nothing about the mother of these boys. Was she also about 500 years old, give or take a few decades, when she conceived? To be fair to the author, while Noah's partner plays absolutely no role, we only hear Noah speak when he curses one of his son's unborn descendants. The deity monologues at length in the Noah story. But the invisibility and silence of Noah's wife makes her an especially intriguing character for a poet. In case your memory of the Old Testament story is rusty, recall the deity is depicted declaring everyone on earth is corrupt and thus intends to commit genocide, sparing only 8 humans, Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives. Noah is told in precise terms the measurement of the ark he must construct and that he must bring on board his family members along with the male and female of every kind of bird, beast, and creeping thing. Noah and his extended family and the animals ride out the flood. Then Noah builds an altar and makes animal sacrifices. The deity puts a rainbow in the sky, both as a covenant with Noah and to remind himself not to kill everyone again through floodwaters. That's enough background information for comprehending our first poem. This is Molly Toomey's Noah's Wife. We hadn't touched in years. All he did was tinker in the shed, mutter to himself. I'll admit, when the first rain hit, I ran onto the boat with the ram and the goat, feared the vixen's teeth, the antlers of the moose. Noah was glued to the wheel, so I set a truce. I wouldn't salt the flank of a cow or rip the leg off a goose. If the buffalo kept its horns to itself and the snake flattened to a belt. I slept with my head on the stomach of an ox. We shared dried apricots and fermented malt. When our ship pulled in, an olive dropped from the dove's lips. Deer flinched. The ape turned away. They ran, crawled, sniffed, and leapt into the sea. As if they knew our pact wouldn't last, like the rainbow in the sky, my husband's hand hovering over mine. Molly Toomey's Noah's Wife. I had to remind myself that a vixen is a female fox. Toomey takes liberties here, of course, as she should when she reimagines this fantastic flood event. The Genesis story does not mention a vixen, or a moose, or an ape. There's also music in this poem, with both internal rhymes and end rhymes. For example, boat, goat, moose, goose, truce, of an ox, apricots. The short line opening the poem suggests some domestic tension in the Noah marriage. We hadn't touched in years. No line in the rest of the poem attempts to assure us that the Noah marriage is solid. pre-flood, he spent his time in his man cave, tinkering and muttering to himself. The majority of the poem concisely details how she conducted herself with some of the animals, the peace they achieved during the extended storm. She shares food and drink with them, dried apricots and fermented malt. That's most curious. She drinks beer with the ox and maybe some of the other animals on board. Noah manned the ark's steering wheel during their time afloat. We're not told how her sons and their wives rode out the storm. The poem's final statement, a fragment that forms the last 2.5 lines, first references the animals that flee after the ark pulls into land, and then 2 more phrases, both somewhat mysterious, follow. The animals leap from the ark, quotes, as if they knew our pact wouldn't last, like the rainbow in the sky, my husband's hand hovering over mine. As is often the case in Old Testament stories, it's not clear whether the women see themselves as part of the covenant, as beholden to this higher power. She may be voicing a suspicion that the rainbow meant to assure that the deity will not kill humans again by floodwaters is merely a temporary promise. Then the final line refers to Noah's hand hovering over hers. Does that suggest their years of intimacy are long past? That not only does he no longer touch her, but he does not bring her into his confidences regarding his loyalty to the divine? Let's hear Noah's Wife by Molly Toomey once again. We hadn't touched in years. All he did was tinker in the shed, mutter to himself. I'll admit, when the first rain hit, I ran onto the boat with the ram and the goat, feared the vixen's teeth, the antlers of the moose. Noah was glued to the wheel, so I set a truce. I wouldn't salt the flank of a cow or rip the leg off a goose if the buffalo kept its horns to itself and the snake flattened to a belt. I slept with my head on the stomach of an ox. We shared dried apricots and fermented malt. When our ship pulled in, an olive dropped from the dove's lips. Deer flinched. The ape turned away. They ran, crawled, sniffed, and leapt into the sea, as if they knew our pact wouldn't last, like the rainbow in the sky, my husband's hand hovering over mine. Let's recall that after Noah and company arrived safely on dry land, the first tiller of the soil, as the Bible labels him, plants a vineyard and drank so much of the wine that he became drunk and lay naked inside his tent. His wife is not mentioned. Molly Toomey ventures where the Bible authors chose not to go. Let's move to the book of Judges. One of many troubling chapters in that book details the role played by Jephthah, designated the role of military leader in the Israelites' conflict with the Ammonites. As the book of Judges asserts, before he goes into battle, Jephthah is possessed by the Spirit of the Lord, and he makes this vow, quotes, "If you will deliver the Ammonites into my hands, then the first creature that comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return from them safely shall be the Lord's. I shall offer that as a whole offering." That's a quote from chapter 11 of the book of Judges. Apparently, some of his livestock dwell under the same roof where Jephthah lives. Jephthah is successful, taking control over 20 Ammonite towns. He returns home, and the first creature to emerge from his home is his daughter, his only child. She welcomes her dad with tambourines and dancing. In a frenzy, Jephthah tears his clothes and explains his vow to his daughter. His daughter is unnamed in the story, though she does speak. She says, "Go ahead and fulfill your vow, but first allow me to roam in the hills with my companions for 2 months so that I may mourn the fact that I will die a virgin." At the end of 2 months, we're told she did return home, and Jephthah carried out his vow. A rare instance in the Bible of human sacrifice carried out by an Israelite and approved by their deity. What might a poet do with such a story, so full of divinely approved violence? The poet J. Estanislao López imagines an alternate ending, the escape of Jephthah's daughter. And that's the title of his 2022 poem. His version presents a daughter who considers her father ridiculous, dangerously so. She's certainly not the dutiful young woman of the biblical account. This is J. Estanislao López's alternate ending, the escape of Jephthah's daughter. Seeing my father tear his clothes at the sight of me, each seam of cloth unspindling to reveal his bare, flexing chest as he wailed a heartfelt regret, I could no longer take him seriously. God, I realized, played favorites and favored fools. Who did he think would walk through the door to greet him? The irony, I could hear the future exclaim, and a virgin sacrifice at that. But I'm no archetype. I fled to the mountains, promising return. But what is a promise, if not an exchange of ideas about ourselves, subject to evolving circumstances? If my nation burns, so be it. Many will be grateful, and there's no lack of men eager to sing of how they suffered greatly and prevailed. J. Estanislao López's alternate ending, the escape of Jephthah's daughter. It's not just the father who's the subject of the daughter's ridicule. The deity's chastised too. God, I realized, played favorites and favored fools. What was this deity thinking when it inspired Jephthah to make such a short-sighted vow? There are 14 lines in this contemporary sonnet by López, and like sonnets of the Elizabethan era, there's a volta, a swerve or sharp turn in line 9. But I'm no archetype, the speaker says. Here she confides in us and reveals what she did not share with her father, and even what she thinks of her father's goal for himself and his Israelite nation. If my nation burns, so be it. She had no part in her father's decisions. Her father operates in an absolutely male world. Dad and the deity agree on their plans. The main feature of this alternate ending? Contrary to the Bible, Jephthah's daughter did not dutifully return to be executed. The poet offers a plot correction on one of the Bible's most sexist and irrationally violent stories. Once again, this is J. Estanislao López's alternate ending, the escape of Jephthah's daughter. Seeing my father tear his clothes at the sight of me, each seam of cloth unspindling to reveal his bare, flexing chest as he wailed a heartfelt regret, I could no longer take him seriously. God, I realized, played favorites and favored fools. Who did he think would walk through the door to greet him? The irony, I could hear the future exclaim, and a virgin sacrifice at that. But I'm no archetype. I fled to the mountains, promising return. But what is a promise if not an exchange of ideas about ourselves, subject to evolving circumstances? If my nation burns, so be it. Many will be grateful, and there's no lack of men eager to sing of how they suffered greatly and prevailed. Lopez does not make it too easy for us to empathize with this woman the Bible says became a human sacrifice. Her ethics are open for business. She says a promise may be considered, quotes, an exchange of ideas about ourselves subject to evolving circumstances. That does sound like a politician's excuse for lying. Then again, her dad was thoughtless, if you want to be kind about it, if not totally nuts. She predicts that many Israelites will be grateful if she does not dutifully return and submit herself to her dad's execution, even when this leads to her father's forces being defeated on the battlefield. As the final line states, there's no lack of men eager to sing of how they suffered greatly and prevailed. Young as she must be, she knows how to read the glory-mongering of her zealous father and his associates. Even if you are not a serious Bible reader, you must have some familiarity with the New Testament character Lazarus, who plays a cameo role in the Gospel of John. His name is embedded in our culture, the man resurrected from the dead. Lazarus has two sisters, Mary and Martha, the former already known to Jesus. The sisters send a message to Jesus that their brother is ill, but when Jesus arrives in their town, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days and has been entombed in a cave. With a small crowd of Jews trailing Mary, she takes Jesus to the cave, and Jesus calls for Lazarus to emerge. John's Gospel says, quotes, "The dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with linen bandages, his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said, 'Loose him, let him go.'" That's from the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John. Lazarus does not speak at all in this memorable passage. The late organ writer Brian Doyle imagines what he might be thinking in the second letter of Lazarus to his sisters. "Beloveds, I don't think we are quite communicating clearly here. What I said was that I think there are two sides to every miracle. And while I am thrilled to be alive and not moldering in the grave, and I have written any number of letters of gratitude to himself, it was inarguably embarrassing to be stripped of the grave clothes with which I was bound hand and foot, and to stand there stark naked, discombobulated, after being called forth by a loud voice. Nor was my skin in what you would call the pink of condition, nor had I eaten in 4 days, but there I was suddenly on display. You would be rattled too, you know you would, the both of you. 'Loose him and let him go,' he says, and everyone oohs and ahs. But you know, then what? You remember what happened next. He moves away down the hill and everyone follows, the fastest sprinting to the front to see what will happen next, the vendors packing their food and wares to move along to the next miracle. But there I am, naked as a jaybird and smelling the high heaven, famished, stunned, reborn, in debt, confused, and utterly alone. I cast no aspersions when I remark that you both followed him. I would have too, had I been capable, And now that I am healthy, I will follow him to the second end of my days. But do allow me simply to note that while it surely was the most memorable day of my entire life, it also certainly was not the most comfortable, or the easiest, or even, dare I say, the best. To me, the day I was married was the best day, or the days my three children arrived. So I can say, even as I am the most thankful man who ever was, that I regret in some small way that for many centuries hence I will not be Eleazar, a decent man, beloved of his many friends, a good father, a patient husband noted for his kindness and wit, but only Lazarus, who was by the Christ returned from the dead. If such be the small price of this new life in which I am at home again in the arms of those I love, among whom I count you too, so be it. But I do think that you, among all women in the world, would understand that miracles breed ripples that do not cease. Brian Doyle's The Second Letter of Lazarus to His Sisters. As the first line indicates, Lazarus is dismayed that Mary and Martha overlook what it felt like to be called forth from the dead. This is his second letter to his sisters, so we may guess they were still congratulating him after he wrote to them the first time. He claims he bears no grudge, that after he emerged from his tomb, his sisters followed Jesus rather than comforted him. I cast no aspersions when I remarked that you both followed him. He wants to set the record straight. It was humiliating to be exposed as he was in front of a small crowd, and he envisions his legacy. He knows he participated in a memorable scene, but it occurred when he was least presentable to the public. His faith in Jesus remains secure. Lazarus has already written a number of thank you letters to Jesus. The second letter of Lazarus to his sisters is spaced like a chunky prose paragraph, with justified margins on both the left and right-hand sides. Doyle called this form a proem, a blend of prose and poetry. He gives voice to a character the Gospel of John author wanted us to presume was silent and had no personality worth noting. Doyle's version of Lazarus realizes his reputation will be based on his role as a passive prop for a Jesus miracle, a role he played when he was stark naked, smelly, and hungry. He had no control over that, and now he's dismayed when contemplating his reputation. In his final line, the proem opens outwards as he tells his sisters, "Miracles breed ripples that do not cease." Again, let's hear Brian Doyle's The Second Letter of Lazarus to His Sisters. Beloveds, I don't think we are quite communicating clearly here. What I said was that I think there are two sides to every miracle. And while I am thrilled to be alive and not moldering in the grave, and I have written any number of letters of gratitude to himself, it was inarguably embarrassing to be stripped of the grave clothes with which I was bound hand and foot, and to stand there stark naked, discombobulated after being called forth by a loud voice. Nor was my skin in what you would call the pink of condition, nor had I eaten in 4 days, but there I was suddenly on display. You would be rattled too. You know you would, the both of you. "Loose him and let him go," he says, and everyone oohs and ahs. But you know, then what? You remember what happened next. He moves away down the hill and everyone follows. the fastest sprinting to the front to see what will happen next, the vendors packing their food and wares to move along to the next miracle. But there I am, naked as a jaybird and smelling to high heaven, famished, stunned, reborn, in debt, confused, and utterly alone. I cast no aspersions when I remarked that you both followed him. I would have too, had I been capable. And now that I am healthy, I will follow him to the second end of my days. But do allow me simply to note that while it surely was the most memorable day of my entire life, it also certainly was not the most comfortable, or the easiest, or even, dare I say, the best. To me, the day I was married was the best day, or the days my three children arrived. So I can say, even as I am the most thankful man who ever was, that I regret in some small way that for many centuries hence I will not be Eleazar, a decent man, beloved of his many friends, a good father, a patient husband, noted for his kindness and wit, but only Lazarus, who was by the Christ returned from the dead. If such be the small price of this new life in which I am at home, again in the arms of those I love, among whom I count you two, so be it. But I do think that you, among all women in the world, would understand that miracles breed ripples that do not cease. Brian Doyle's The Second Letter of Lazarus to His Sisters. This episode has been barely an introduction to poems that revise Bible stories. This and all past episodes of Poems for Company are available on the podcast page at kmun.org and on a wide variety of apps. Our theme music is Going to the Sun by Philip Auberg from his CD Live from Montana. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.